I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There is news today from Democratic presidential candidate John Edwards. The candidate called a press conference at noon East Coast time after canceling an Iowa campaign appearance earlier this week to join his wife in what had been described as a routine follow-up medical appointment. His wife, as we know, had suffered from breast cancer. So this press conference is raising concerns, of course, about Elizabeth Edwards and questions about John Edwards' campaign. Bob Benenson is editor of Congressional Quarterly Magazine. He joins us on the line. Bob, as we all wait, there are pictures of the podium on CNN, but John Edwards has not yet spoken. What are people saying?
You know, we're hearing conflicting reports on the news media right now. One political website in Washington said that Edwards is going to announce that he's suspending his campaign in light of health developments involving his wife. CNN just reported that the Edwards campaign is, you know, in their words, pushing back against those rumors, saying that they're not true.
Right.
So I think we're just going to have to sit tight and wait until the words come out of Edwards' mouth.
And we will do that. And by the way, Here Now listeners, we'll let you know what he says when he says it. But Bob, remind us about Elizabeth Edwards' condition, diagnosed with cancer in 2004 during the last days of that campaign. This was a routine checkup this week.
Yes, that's right. She said several follow-up checkups, according to the Edwards campaign, and appeared to be cancer-free, but I happen to be a cancer survivor myself, and I know that you always have to remain vigilant about it. It's a long-term process, and it's a sneaky thing, and there could be some cancerous cells still residing somewhere in your body and not immediately apparent in the aftermath of surgery and treatment that come up. I think the message that people should take from this is that they should see their doctors frequently when they may have this kind of problem.
Well, what has Edwards said about his wife's health in relationship to his run?
Well, you know, she's been a real participant in Mr. Edwards' political career. His one term in the United States Senate representing North Carolina, his initial campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination in 2004, where he fell short, but still made a positive impression on a lot of Democrats, which led to his choice as vice presidential running mate.
Right, but he also said this year that he would make his decision, almost daily on whether to run, depending on her health, and she would have to have a clean bill of health.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, they appear to be about as close to a model American family as you can imagine, and they're very, very close.
Well, John Edwards has been a third-place candidate in the polls, lagging behind Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, but his followers have complained vociferously that the media has ignored his campaign, and he's, for instance, been out there with workers quite a bit, talking about labor issues, poverty issues, health issues, another one. I'm wondering, though, on a practical level, and of course we wish for the best, but it would seem as if there is something to be said about his wife's health. Can he raise the money necessary to succeed if he does cut back on his appearances?
You know what the thing is about this situation is we're talking about a fully developed presidential campaign astoundingly early. If he has to suspend his campaign, if he gets off the campaign fundraising trail, if he stops making the tour, yes, it would be a setback. But on the other hand, if it turned out that Mrs. Edwards' condition is not tremendously serious, that it can be contained within, say, a few months' time,
he might get
back
back
on the road to recovery.
Bob Benenson, editor of Congressional Quarterly Magazine, we're going to keep listening in and come back to this issue, but we'll take a break for now. Bob, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, we will return to this story as it warrants. But meanwhile, a new book from journalist Tom Bissell reminds us that as the Iraq War enters its fifth year, there will soon be a new generation of children wondering, what did the war do to my dad or mom? Tom's mom was the daughter of a Marine colonel, his dad a Marine officer and Vietnam combat veteran. Living in Michigan's Upper Peninsula in the 1970s, Vietnam was Tom's dad's invisible drinking mate.
There were two types of Vietnam veteran: those who talked about the war and those who did not talk about it. My father talked about the war. though if anything, this only deepened the abyss between us. I'd learned something from discussions with those who had veteran fathers. This was that our father seemed remote, because the war itself was impossibly remote. Chances were the war had happened pre-you, before you recognized that the reality of yourself, your bedroom, your dolls and comic books had nothing to do with the reality of your father. This strange lost war, simultaneously real and unimaginable, forced us to confront the past before we had any idea of what the past really was. Despite its remoteness, the war's after effects were inescapably intimate. At every meal, Vietnam sat down invisibly with our families.
But Tom Bissell tries to bridge that abyss by leaping into it, taking his dad on a trip back to where his dad landed on the beach or was thrown into the air by a booby trap, to try to know more about this man still flying, still ripped apart. Tom tells that story and, parallel to it, the history of the war in his new book, The Father of All Things, A Marine, His Son, and the Legacy of Vietnam. And Tom Bissell joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
What a read. I mean, I've told you, this is just so compelling. What did you hope to gain from the trip?
Well, I hoped to see this place that I always wanted to go see, obviously Vietnam, which is, as you know, a magical place. And it has tons of problems, as you also know, and it has a ruthless authoritarian government, et cetera, et cetera. But
because we have shared that I have made a trip to Vietnam, and I'm wondering, I mean, that's what you know now, and it maybe fascinated you, but when you first landed with your dad back to this place where he'd been torn apart, what was that feeling first like when you're in Vietnam?
Yeah. Well, I can tell you the really amazing thing that happened right away. We come out into the customs area and we're getting our baggage and I'm sort of stunned, you know, jet lag. And I see this old Vietnamese woman struggling with her bags off the baggage carousel. And my father sort of leaned over and he helped this old Vietnamese woman lift her bag off the baggage carousel. And to see that little moment of kindness between my father and this old Vietnamese woman was... For some reason, it just kind of hit me like a lightning bolt. And I was like, wow, that's really kind of magnificent that 40 years on, this place where my father very nearly was killed, we're back, and he is helping a citizen of this country that succumbed to something he fought and suffered so hard to prevent from happening.
Who was the dad you grew up with, and who was the one you took to Vietnam?
The father I grew up with was a man who oftentimes would wake me up in the middle of the night after he'd had a bit too much to drink. He and my mother had been divorced by this point. And some nights, as I describe in the book, I would wake up to find him sitting there, as often as not, with tears in his eyes, and he'd want to talk. And to be a kid with a father who had that kind of turmoil inside of him, and I should stress that my father was never a violent or unpleasant man throughout all this. He just seemed hurt and damaged in some profound way.
Still, though, I mean, you both seem to share a sense of humor during a particularly rough game of rocks, papers, and scissors you called a child abuse hotline.
Yeah. Our life together was one of filled with constant practical jokes. As I write in the book, that I tell these stories of my dad and I basically beating the crap out of each other in a very loving way. And I expect people to think, oh, God, what a great dad you have. Instead, people just stare back at me with, like, open-mouthed horror and shock.
But, I mean, it's a great picture because you got along, you loved each other, but you didn't understand him, and maybe he didn't understand you, because let's talk about who you were. You were a kid who cried on hunting trips.
Yeah.
The closest you got to war at one point was paintball. I mean, you know, just looking at you as a young kid, you maybe weren't a Marine's son in some ways.
I was not. In fact, I joined the Peace Corps, which is about as close as I could come to anything with Corps in the name. But at the same time, all that stuff was really fascinating to me. And I've, you know, done some war reporting now as a nonfiction writer. And it's kind of brought me full circle, you know, from a completely different angle of my father's experiences.
Well, you're right. You were in Afghanistan once when you realized you became a writer interested in human suffering, maybe in part to learn something about what your father went through.
I think that part of the reason I have become interested in war as a writer is due to my absolutely traceable to my father and the mystery of him.
Well, and that's who you both were when you set off for Vietnam, an older man, a son who'd become a writer who covered wars but still didn't understand the one his father fought in. Did you have a set sort of like, my father's going to say to me this?
I wasn't expecting any kind of moment where everything sort of fell into place and he had tears streaming down his face, you know, anything like that. I was not expecting that. And the book, in fact, doesn't really have anything like that.
But there are moments maybe even more profound. You visited My Lai, or the memorial where the My Lai massacre actually took place. 500 men, women, and children slaughtered by U.S. soldiers, led by Lieutenant William Calley. What did your dad think?
My Lai was always a place that my father would maintain the media exaggerated it. It wasn't representative of the American behavior, etc. But to go to that place and to see those photos, I think forced my father for really the first time to really recognize that even though My Lai was not representative of the United States in Vietnam, that sort of doesn't really matter because it happened. And to see my father stand literally alongside the ditch looking down in it with one of the most haunting and drawn expressions I've ever seen on his face, knowing that that ditch had been filled with human beings. He just wanted to stand there and quietly pay his respects to this. And we've never had a conversation about My Lai since then in which he's uttered one peep of
defense
or kind of sidelong justification for it. And as I write in the book, my father is actually friendly with Captain Medina, who is the captain of the there were three platoons that went into My Lai, and he was the head of these three platoons. After he read the section that I wrote, I asked him what he thought about his friend now, and this is all he's ever said about it. I accept the validity of what you wrote, and I don't think he's going to get much beyond that, and I'm comfortable with that, you know.
Yeah. And yet, out of that My Lai experience, he also explained to you in an extraordinary exchange that you had that this stuff happened. I mean, it's on page 268. It actually spans a few pages. And I wonder if you could read that. You know, he says, everyone was cheering us. That's my biggest frustration when I talk to people who are in here. They'll say nobody wanted you to come to Vietnam. And, well, they welcomed us with open arms. And then he points up at the hills. Would you do me a favor and read from where he's describing the hills?
Sure. He pointed to the hills beyond Quy Nhon, an Arcadia of rough, beautiful triangles of fuzzy jade and sharp spurs of exposed white rock. A few sparkling white waterfalls pouring down the hill's faces. Those look beautiful, but they're meaner than a son of a bitch to walk up and down. The VC was there, as we found out. It only took 2 days before we were fired on. The first six people we killed were all women, armed and shooting at us, mind you. He had never told me this before. Dad, my God, what was it like? It was like what you'd expect it to be like. I threw up. No one joins the Marines to shoot women.
What was it like to hear from your dad?
That he had shot
women?
Women. Well, as I point out in the next paragraph, you can quibble to little probable value about the ethics of using women in a guerrilla war. Mm. I'm not prepared to judge my father for killing an insurgent who's shooting at him, but it's certainly in 1965 there would have been something very spooky about shooting a bunch of women in this country that you've been sent to, quote, you know, save from communism. And that was the first time he'd ever told me that.
Yeah.
And I wondered if a lot of the stuff like that, there are little moments like this throughout the book that just come up, stuff he's never said to me before. And it was almost as if, you know, being dropped into this place again sort of exhumed a lot of stuff that he just either didn't want to remember or had felt very comfortable to forget.
That's Tom Bissell. His book is The Father of All Things, A Marine, His Son, and the Legacy of Vietnam. We're going to have much more with Tom. And this reminder, we're waiting for John Edwards' announcement about his wife's health and its possible impact on his own presidential campaign. We'll have all of this for you after a quick break. Stay right there, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with more from Tom Bissell, one of the first children of Vietnam vets to write about the war's impact on him and his family. He and his dad took a trip back to Vietnam, to the place where his dad's arm was almost blown off by a booby trap, to Cu Chi, a formal battleground turned into a sort of war amusement park where his dad jumped into the tunnels used by the National Liberation Front, or Viet Cong, and Tom tried his hand at a rifle range. But Tom, you said the first time you noticed your dad's scars was when you stood where he'd been injured. What more did you learn there?
In particular was the story of his wounding, which I had grown up believing he'd been shot in some roadside melee and then was dragged to safety by a black Marine. It was so vivid. I had seen it. I'd imagined that he'd told me the story many, many times. And in fact, we'd go to the spot of his wounding and I'd learned that in fact it was not a black Marine. He was not shot. He was blown up by what you'd call today a roadside bomb. I'll never forget it. I've gone back and listened to the tape a few times again, you know, because when I was writing it, I was obviously transcribing all the hours and hours of interviews that I'd taken with him. And there's just something about that exchange that we have there. When he tells the story, there's a good, like, 15 seconds of silence on my end where I'm sitting there thinking,
Where's the
black Marine that saved his life? And in fact, there was no black Marine. He wasn't shot. And I realize that when you're the son of a vet, particularly in a war that did not, shall we say, go according to plan, there's a lot of mythologizing that goes on in any war, but particularly one in which the war has a shameful legacy, A, and B, the war was not won. So you have to do all these kind of ad hoc heroism injections into the story for yourself to sort of redeem your father's role in the lost war. And I had realized that by creating this multicultural tableau of gallantry, you know, I had created something that made my father's experience maybe more palatable to me.
Yeah. The last place you go to with your dad, the village of Bendouac.
Where's this? Oh, the Kuchi Tunnels?
The Kuchi Tunnels.
Yeah.
And there's a moment where you pick up a gun.
An AK-47.
Your dad didn't seem to like you picking up a gun.
He was not thrilled to see this. And at the time, I thought he was just, you know, actually worried that I was going to hurt myself or something like that. But in fact, I, as the scene goes on and I'm firing this weapon, I realize that this might not be a great thing for my father to hear, because the AK has a very distinctive sound. And obviously, I don't want to overstate this, because, like, you know, gunfights of the kind where, you know, you're hiding behind a wall and exchanging fire with people is not the kind of fighting that went on in Vietnam for the most part. But seeing his son fire an AK-47, the guy with whom is helping his son fire this weapon is dressed up like an NLF guerrilla.
Yeah.
I had to realize that this is probably not the easiest thing for my father to watch, you know, despite how much he's mellowed and despite the distance he's come about his feelings from Vietnam. And I think, you know, into the firing of that gun, I was trying to experience something, and I realized that this was actually a fairly appalling thing for this man's son to be doing right in front of him, and so I stopped.
Mm. It felt as if it was maybe seeing you with a, you know, Viet Cong NLF fighter at this sort of Disneyland in Vietnam, but also seeing you. I mean, in a way, I bet he wishes you never have to pick up a gun.
I think he'd probably be happy if that never happened to me, yeah.
You end up at a restaurant just before he leaves. You stay on. And you have this extraordinary conversation where he tells you kind of how he feels about the war now. What does he say?
He, and this, I swear to you, is absolutely verbatim from transcript. There's no augmentation going on here. My father says, "I know you want me to tell you that I think the war was wrong, but I don't." And I say, "Dad, I don't want you to tell me you think the war is," but then he silences me with a glare. "However, in the end, I think, after 12 days here, I think, probably, in all likelihood, though I say this with some misgiving, I think, all in all, it's best that everything turned out the way it did." And
and you say, "Really?" Keep going, because this is amazing. Really?
"Really? You can say that? I can now. So how does that make you feel?" He looked away. "Sad the whole thing occurred, but mostly understanding." He seemed to think about this word. His eyebrows lifted and stayed there. "Understanding, you mean that the war wasn't your story or an American story, but a different story, a Vietnamese story in which you only played a small and terrible part? Let's not go crazy. Just understanding. You can't predict the future. What would we have done here? Say we won everything, took over all the country's provinces, crushed the communists. What would we have done?"
Yeah.
For him to basically drop all the cant, to come out and say that this is what happened, I'm not going to defend this anymore, I'm not going to refight it in my mind, this war is over, and for better or for worse, this is the way things are, and I can live with that. That is the moment that he was going toward.
And in fact, he even said, "for better."
Yeah.
You know, and I wonder, too, because here you are. You're one of the first voices of a grown-up child of a Vietnam veteran, a very new experience for Americans. Your dad, who everyone wants their dad to be a hero, lost the war.
They lost the war.
At the end of this trip, can you, you know, is it easier for you because you can still hold to your beliefs and you've researched this, you know, deeply about the war and that it was a mistake before they executed? And still think your father, in many ways, you know, did some heroic things by being there. Can you have both simultaneously?
I absolutely can. And he tells the story of hitting the water buffalo, which earned my father the nickname Nice Guy. The convoy he was in hit a water buffalo, and the general flying, you know, imperially in the helicopter above this convoy was saying, "Move on out of there." And my dad said, "Actually, the hell with you. I'm paying this peasant
for the dead water buffalo."
For the dead water buffalo, which, as is our orders. When we kill the local people's animals, we will compensate them. That's when I realized that, you know, within every war, even at My Lai, the horror is intercut with gusts of strange human kindness. And I'm totally prepared to believe that my father conducted himself with the behavior that would benefit a well-trained intelligent and empathetic, you know, Marine.
In fact, right after you have that stunning conversation with him in the restaurant, he gets up and talks to the owner of the restaurant who's come over to him, who turns out to be a former South Vietnamese veteran. And they have this stunning exchange where they both talk about bad memories, just get rid of bad memories. And then what does that soldier say to you?
My father says, "This is my son." And the man says, "Your father is a good man. He loves you. I think he loves all people." And I do think my dad loves all people. And I think going to Vietnam actually has allowed him to love all people even even less tormentedly, you know.
Yeah. Tom Bissell, the book is The Father of All Things, A Marine, His Son, and the Legacy of Vietnam. Thanks so much for coming in to talk about it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. We now have sad news from John Edwards. His wife's cancer has returned. We'll have much more on that after the break. This is Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And there is news today on the Democratic presidential campaign trail. Candidate John Edwards says his wife's cancer has returned. He's also said, though, that his campaign will go on. The candidate called a press conference at noon East Coast time after canceling an Iowa campaign appearance this week to join his wife in what had been described as a routine follow-up medical appointment. And today's announcement, of course, raises concerns first and foremost about Elizabeth Edwards' health, but also questions about the campaign. Let's listen to a little of what was said today.
The campaign goes on. The campaign goes on strongly. Elizabeth and I have talked at length about this already, talked with our children about it. Basically, as I mentioned earlier, we've been confronted with these kind of traumas and struggles already in our life. And we know from our previous experience that when this happens, you have a choice. You can go cower in the corner and hide, or you can be tough and go out there and stand up for what you believe in. And both of us are committed to the cause. We're committed to changing this country that we love so much. And we have no intention of cowering in the corner.
We turn now to Bob Bedinson, editor of CQPolitics.com. And Bob, I'm thinking that when John Edwards refers to previous experiences, he might be referring to his wife's previous breast cancer or to the fact that they lost a son in a car accident. That was one portion of what we heard today. There was another very chilling moment when John Edwards announced the cancer has returned and it is malignant. What did he say about the cancer?
Well, what he said was is that the cancer has spread to bone in Mrs. Edwards' right ribcage, which is obviously not a good thing. Mm-hmm. It is not both Mr. and Mrs. Edwards emphasized. It is not a death sentence. It is something that is treatable. It is something that can be hopefully contained, but it's not something that's going to go away.
Yeah,
and so that the difficult times are ahead for that family.
They said that the doctor that they spoke with said to them it would be like diabetes. It would be something that was manageable. However, they both well. How do they look to you?
These are two very courageous people, and especially Mrs. Edwards, who's suffering from this disease. They could not have gone out there and presented a more positive, optimistic view of a very difficult situation. And, of course, as you mentioned, Senator Edwards, with his wife's concurrence, said they are going to keep going full steam ahead on his bid to... Mm-hmm. Win the Democratic presidential nomination and become the next president of the United States. So for people and there are millions of us out there who have in some way, shape, or form an acquaintance with cancer.
You yourself have.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, and I also have to monitor it right now. It's mm-hmm. It's good, but you know you have to stay on top of it. If nothing else. Her demeanor and her effort to stay positive and to fight this as hard as she can has got to be inspirational to a lot of people going through what is definitely a traumatic situation.
Let's listen to Elizabeth Edwards.
That I'm absolutely ready for this. I'm ready for that. I mean, I honestly have all the energy. I mean, one of the reasons to do a press conference as opposed to a press release is that you can see. I mean, I don't look sickly. I don't feel sickly. And, you know, I'm as ready as any person can be for that. I mean, you know how grueling it is in general. There is a likelihood that some of the medications that I will be taking will at sometimes make me tired. I have, as you all well know, and a lot of you know that my younger children, 6 and 8 year old, if I get tired, I actually expect they're going to be the reason, as opposed to the medications that Dr. Carey is going to be giving me. But there's a chance that both of them will make me tired sometimes, and so sometimes I'll step back.
Bob Edinson, although, as you said, these are two remarkable people, she does look thin. I mean, she said she looks well, but I was struck by, you know, that she does look thin.
Yeah, that's a little hard to judge. Appearances, you know, we try and stay away from that. But Mrs. Edwards' weight has fluctuated over time, and it's hard to say whether that is a result of the disease or if she'd been dieting or
who knows
or working out or whatever.
Well, now there have been earlier reports today on some websites, Politico.com among them, that John Edwards was going to suspend his campaign, possibly even end it. He, as he said today, was not going to do either. He at times sounded shattered, as one would, mm-hmm. but as you also pointed out, remarkably strong. Is there a sense that, you know, that he could afford at all to back down on campaigning, given that he is a third in the polls? His many supporters complain loudly that the media has not been covering him because of the Barack Obama-Hillary Clinton battle. So he seems to have to work harder than the other two just to get, you know, some coverage. It seems like there is a very tough road ahead.
Yes, there definitely is, and it would have been a very challenging circumstance for him to completely step out of the campaign and then hope to get back in. Not impossible. We discussed earlier that we're talking about a full-blown presidential campaign at a point that is so far earlier than in any other previous election cycle that if there was a circumstance where somebody could take a break from the campaign and then come in, and, you know, in a similar fashion that a couple of prominent figures, former Vice President Al Gore and former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, are hanging back at the fringes of this this contest and have the potential to get in later than anybody else simply because they're so well known. That's not saying that would necessarily be a successful strategy. But, you know, the fact of the matter is the reason these candidates are out there so early, John Edwards announced this campaign the last week in December, is that there are so many prominent names in the field and there's so much money that these candidates are going to have to raise in order to be viable candidates, especially given the practice known as front-loading, which is all the states rushing to the beginning of the year next year to hold their primaries. It's not just New Hampshire and Iowa anymore. California's moved its primary up to February 5th. New York's going to do the same. Florida may move even earlier. These are big, media-intensive states that all these candidates are going to need a lot of money in order to campaign seriously. And so it's as long as the situation is positive, as long as the doctors and Mrs. Edwards and John Edwards think that his continued campaigning and her continued campaigning on his behalf will not negatively affect her prognosis, then he's probably wise to stay in there, stay on track. And of course, you know, one of the interesting things that could occur here is that he could draw more positive public attention and perhaps mm-hmm. more sympathy because people are seeing these people, you know, braving their way through this hard situation that make other candidates' campaign travails look minor by consequence.
Right. Bob Benenson, just a few seconds left. It is remarkable as well to think that you know, decades ago the word cancer couldn't even be uttered, and now a presidential candidate is saying his wife has it and they're running for president.
That's absolutely true, and that's a positive development. It really is. It's positive in the sense that medical science has advanced to the point that people can live with this.
Right.
They can be treated. They have better long-term prognosis.
And Bob Edison, editor of CQPolitics.com, we wish you continued success in the management of your own cancer. Thanks so much
Thank
for speaking
much.
With us. Yeah, take care. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, running alongside all the news of the past couple of weeks and, frankly, distracting us often from the news. College basketball's March Madness continues. We head into the Sweet 16 action tonight with the men resuming their games. On Saturday, the women play again. And joining us to talk about the continuing court dances and other sporting news, Only a Game host Bill Littlefield. Bill, welcome as always.
Thank you, Robin.
And again, what a distraction this can be sometimes from, as we've just heard, the more serious things in life. The brackets. How are you doing?
I'm not exactly the king of the world, but I'm kind of poised. I'm the crown prince of the world.
You're
right
doing
now.
Pretty well, and I just want to rush to say you were the one that said Tiny Winthrop would beat Notre Dame in the first round, and
yes.
You, my friend, were right.
That was one of my triumphs. Let it be said that I filled out my brackets while waiting for somebody to get off the phone, somebody that I had to talk to. I think I did it in 90 seconds, and so this is proof positive that thinking about this is absolutely pointless.
Yeah. Well, tell us what's ahead.
Well, unfortunately, Wisconsin is out, and that was the one thing that hurt me in the brackets. Besides that, as long as Kansas, North Carolina, and Ohio continue to proceed as form dictates that they should, all will be well in the world. And then, of course, in the women's side, you have the ultimate Cinderella team, possibly, in Marist College, the other college in Poughkeepsie.
Marist College taking on number one ranked Tennessee. Marist already pulled off one of the tournament's biggest upsets, beating Ohio State in the first round. They went on to upset Middle Tennessee in the second round. Can they do it again?
You want the short answer?
Yeah.
No.
Okay.
If they do, I don't want to be in Pat Summitt's locker room when that one's over.
They'll go sit with the men's Winthrop team, Proud they've come as far as they have.
They're happy to be where they are, I'm quite sure.
Right. And just let's remind ourselves, on the men's side again, the regional semifinals start tonight, four games. The first game, Memphis playing Texas A&M. Second, top seed Ohio State squaring off against Tennessee. So that's how that's shaping up. Okay. This week on your show, Only a Game, to remind listeners, your series of pieces on the sports scene in Pittsburgh continues with a profile of what we hear is a colorful ex-cop and the equally colorful cast of characters who train in the boxing gym.
Yes, this is Jimmy Savetic, who runs a gym on 3rd Avenue in Pittsburgh. It's hidden in the basement of a delicatessen, which he also owns. It's hilarious.
Bill Littlefield. Seeking out sports.
It's magnificent. I called him up and I said, you know, he was supposed to put on a show. There was supposed to be Golden Gloves bout the night that I was arriving in Pittsburgh. And I called him 2 days. He said, I canceled it. And I said, well, Jimmy, what am I going to do? And he said, come on by. I'll have the Russian boxer. I'll have the Vietnamese boxer. I'll have the card girl there for you. You want to meet the mayor? I'll have the mayor come by. He's a good friend of mine. So I knew I was going to get a story no matter what.
Yeah. Well, and just give us the headline.
Well, I suppose the headline is the ex-cop, the ex-communist, and the ex-con all together in a Pittsburgh boxing gym.
And getting along famously, except absolutely. When one bloodies another's nose. Okay. So look for that. Our own beloved Red Sox left fielder Manny Ramirez, we just have to touch on this. He broke his spring training silence.
Branching off into sales.
Yeah. He says it's as a favor for a friend. He's auctioning off this deluxe barbecue grill on eBay. Mm-hmm. Now, the bids were just astronomical, and some people were wondering, Manny, why do you have to sell grills on eBay? So he's finally come through and said why. I guess, did he pull the bid off?
Or? Well, my understanding is when the bids reached $999,999, the eBay counter can't go any higher. And so the whole thing, it blew up, basically. No, Manny was trying to do a friend a favor, he said, in typical Manny fashion. Albeit somewhat fraudulent fashion, representing himself as the seller of the grill.
When it was someone else. Well, besides that, how is spring training shaping up for you, or is it too early?
Oh, it's always fun, to see what's going on. Apparently, Dice K, at this point, is in fact throwing pitches that are mystifying at least the Pittsburgh Pirates,
Dice
for whatever
K,
that's worth.
The new pitcher for the Red Sox?
The $100 million pitcher that the Red Sox have acquired. And so, that's good. Their investment is looking very solid in late March.
And are the Yankees still fighting?
Yeah, and the beautiful story out of the Yankees, of course, is that A-Rod, Alex Rodriguez, has announced that he intends to spend all of his career in New York, which means that he's probably advised his agent to look for another team.
Bill Littlefield covers sports and much more each week and on his NPR program, Only a Game. Look for that. And Bill, as always, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Author and photographer Kip Fulbeck struck a chord with his book, Part Asian, 100% Hapa. In it, he gathers pictures of multiracial Americans, along with their answers to his question, what are you? As he writes, for him, it's a question he also gets a lot, and it doesn't have a simple answer.
I get mistaken for Native American, Filipino, Hawaiian, African American, especially when my head is shaved, Mexican, Cuban, Middle Eastern, Indian. I've listened to a black woman chastise me for denying my African heritage, and a First Nations member pushed me to register my status. I'm greeted in Spanish, Farsi, and Pidgin, all the while being escorted to the various back tables in various Chinese restaurants and handed forks. The long hair, non-Gucci tattoo tables, the brown tables. On the street, interracial couples approach and scrutinize my face, wondering out loud what their future child might look like. And I learn to smile back when they do it. They're just curious, right?
That's Kip Fulbeck reading from his book of photos, Part Asian, 100% Hapa. It's part of Kip's Hapa project, and yes, we're going to find out what Hapa means. And by the way, you can follow along and see the pictures at our website, here-now.org. We spoke to Kip when his book was first published last year, and our first question was, what is the answer to what are you for you?
Well, when the question comes up, I usually default to the ethnicity thing, and I usually say I'm Hapa. And people then say, well, what does that mean?
Right.
And I say it means part Asian, part Pacific Islander, part something else. And if they keep going, I'll say I'm Chinese, English, Irish, Welsh. What are you?
Right. And that brings us to what was going to be my second blunt question, Hapa. This is a word that we understand came from Hawaii?
Yeah, it's a Hawaiian word. It literally means half or portion. And prior to 1960, it was used in the phrase Hapa Haole for people that were part Hawaiian and part white. Later, it started to become people that are part Asian or Pacific Islander.
And when did you know you were a Hapa?
I think I was told when I was about 4 or 5. I had some, you know, Chinese relatives that said, you're Hapa. And I said, okay.
Whatever that means. Well, and we explore what it means to the many people that you photographed and put in the book. Why did you do this? Why did you take on this project?
Well, I can answer it in some pretty theoretical ways, but the real reason is just I wanted to make the book that I wish I had around as a kid. I mean, for me growing up, I was born in 65, so I was born 2 years before all the laws went off the books that banned interracial marriages in this country.
Right.
So in some weird way, my birth is kind of illegal. And for me growing up, every ethnicity question I had, every job application or school form always made me pick one or the other, pick mom or dad. And I thought that was really crazy. So I thought I would make this book to let people tell who they were in their own words.
Let's take a look at some of the pictures. And by the way, they're on our website, here-now.org. And as we said, one side of the book has the full, beautiful pictures of people from the neck up, no adornments, no jewelry, no makeup, just staring straight at the camera. On the left side, the page has in their writing their own descriptions of themselves and their answer to your question. And I want to look at the first one on page 171. There's a little guy looking at us. Well, he's not a little boy.
That kid. Oh, yeah. I know. He's Filipino-Mexican-Irish. He's probably about 10 years old, and he writes down his statement, I'm a very little boy in fifth grade that has no friends, or as he writes, has no friends. And that's actually the only kid, I photographed over 1,000 people, he's the only kid I actually tried to intervene with what he wrote. I actually tried to, like, influence him. I said, look, you got it right, you've got one friend. And he's like, I don't have any friends. And then, it's funny, I did a show here in San Francisco, I had a gallery show, and a guy in his 40s came up to me and said, that little kid that has no friends, I really feel it. I said, oh, I know it. We've all been that kid at some point. And the guy said, kid, I'm talking about now.
Well, and you talk about when you were a little kid, there was an exercise at one point where everybody had to go up and put a flag in their country of origin.
We had this map that went across the whole wall of the room, and everyone had their little thumbtacks with their initials. And, you know, we went up one by one and put our initials in these countries. And I watched the entire part of Western Europe get filled up. And then so it finally came to my turn. I went dead last. I went to England. I went to Ireland, plopped my flag in there, and then I had to walk what seemed like about 3 miles across this room to China and just stick it in there, and all these kids sort of snickered and laughed, and it really stuck with me.
Yeah. So here's your chance to perhaps, you know, make that book for all those little kids to see, you know, all the different faces that you've assembled and all the different flags. I'm looking now at page 55. Here's a woman who's Filipina, Norwegian, and Irish, but as she says, Norwegian blood really sucks the color out of everything.
Well, you know who that is, Robin?
No, who's that?
That's Linda Barry, the comic artist.
Oh, my gosh, so it is.
She does a lot of work in her book, 100 Demons, where she talks about growing up with the Filipino culture.
Yeah, and as she writes in her explanation, she says in family portraits, those who had the Norwegian background, and again, this was a Filipina family she grew up in, we look like neighbors who just dropped by for some really good food and beer.
Yeah, that's really funny.
What was the overall reaction from people you asked to pose?
unbelievably supportive. I never had to recruit. I went and shot around the country, over 1,000 people, and all I did was announce on the website and people would show up. I would do shoots where there would be 30, 40, 50 people at the door before I got there.
You know, I'm wondering, especially now in light of the country's conversation about immigrants, illegal and otherwise, did you feel a sense of, you know, people wanting to claim this, who they are?
Well, we live in a country that really divides by race. I mean, our whole history is based, you know, on, you know, issues of slavery and Jim Crow laws and so forth. And we have this thing where we're always dividing and dividing and dividing. But if you're Hapa, you really don't have a place to fit in. I mean, it wasn't until the 2000 census, that, you know, 6 years ago, where you could actually put down more than one box. Before that, we have millions of people that can't check more than one box. It's ridiculous.
Well, in fact, you did a reading about your experience. And you write that you could be questioned by some people about what they see in you, but at the same time maybe rejected by other people because of what they see in you. You were talking about how, you know, you're greeted in Spanish and Farsi, but escorted to back tables in Chinese restaurants. The brown tables, what's that?
Never Chinese enough in my family. I mean, I'm really dark. I'm a swimmer and surfer, and I'm covered in tattoos, and so I really don't fit a traditional sort of good Chinese boy stereotype, although I was pre-med at one point. I did do that for a while.
Now, you're the one saying that. I hasten to point out.
Everyone talks about, like, have you gone back to China? I've gone back to China many, many times, but people expect this to be some kind of Joy Luck Club thing where you go back and people will embrace you and take you to your ancestors' village and, oh, you're here, this is for you. And it's not like that at all.
No.
I mean, you go back there, I'm an American.
The reactions are just all across the board, and some very funny, some poignant, as we said, but some very funny. I'm looking at the little boy on page 31. He's Chinese and Danish. There's a problem there. Explain.
Well, he says, I'm part Chinese and part Danish. I don't usually tell people I'm Danish, though, because they think I'm a pastry. Which I thought was great because he's probably told that joke and his parents have probably told that joke his whole life, but I'd never heard that. And what I thought was great about, you know, doing the project for me is I learned so much about people because everyone gets to have their own statement. And so even though that's something that's old to him, it was really fresh and new to me.
Kip, I'm looking right now at a picture of a little Cuban Japanese Jewish girl on page 40. But some of these people, and we've been really poring over them, you can't see any Asian in them.
Yeah, she's really interesting. She's Kwapa, so she's a quarter. Her father is actually in the book as well. He's Hapa, and so she's really one quarter Japanese. And there's people that are quarter Japanese that, you know, phenotypically it looks really strong, but she, you would never tell.
By the way, what's phenotypically?
Phenotypically is the way you actually look physically on the outside.
Another subject on page 153 says to you, shouldn't you be asking my name first? She's Chinese and African American. What should we do, you who are Hapa? Is it insulting for people to ask?
I'm a little different than most people I've talked to in the book. Most people get very offended by it. I actually don't have a problem with what are you, so long as people are treating it with respect and so long as they are willing to answer the question themselves. And so when I have someone run up across the street and say, like, oh, what are you First Nations? What tribe are you? And I say, well, I'm Chinese, English, Irish. And so what are you? Oh, I'm just white. And they walk away. I say, hold on a second. Let's have a little chat here, because what does just white mean?
You tell me what you are, too.
Yeah. As long as it's a discussion and people are willing to sort of give of themselves, I think it's a great thing. I think we need to talk about this.
Kip Fulbeck talking about his book of photos, Part Asian, 100% Hapa. For more information on that and Kip's Hapa project, go to our website, here-now.org. And as Kip said, one shouldn't ask the question, what are you, without answering it yourself. So I'm Dutch, English, and I think there's a little Scottish in there as well. We leave you with John Lennon's Beautiful Boy, written for his son, Sean Lennon, who is Hapa and wrote the intro to Kip's book. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.